You are listening to Alchemy Pod, a RamsDigital.com sponsored podcast.
This article was first published, titled Alchemy is Alive and Well by Hans Nitzel, in the Gnosis magazine, number 8, summer 1988. It was reprinted as Alchemy of the World Today by Hans Nitzel in the Fate magazine in 1991, volume 44, number 1. Editor Donald Michael Craig, a Llewellyn periodical. This article is presented as a historical document. Many of the details and individuals mentioned in the article have passed on or are no longer active, or some of the details were incorrect. This article, Alchemy is Alive and Well, has historical value as a window into alchemy in the 1980s. Alchemy is Alive and Well by Hans Nitzel. Whilst it hasn't made the front pages yet, alchemy is enjoying a revival. The truth is, it never went away. It merely has kept a low profile. Yet more attention is being given to alchemy than ever before. We will look at some of the reasons for this, but first, it might be well to explain what we mean by the term alchemy. A one-word definition is evolution or transmutation. The implication is, one thing is being changed into another thing. As an everyday example, consider the sun. It is truly an alchemist, as it constantly is transmuting hydrogen into helium. Wine that has gone sour is wine that has been transmuted into vinegar. Modern alchemists, understanding that the best kind of vinegar is made from red wine, deliberately try to turn wine sour. However, wineries add sulfides to the wine to prevent souring. Fortunately, some wineries do not do this, and there are also ways of eliminating the sulfides from wine. And yes, this transmutation also includes lead into gold. So we are surrounded by everyday examples of alchemy. The making of a pot of tea is an alchemical process, as it extracts an essence, called sulfur, by alchemists, to colour the water, which we then call tea. It might be noted that the term sulfur is an alchemical code word that, in this instance, refers to the natural oils in the tea or in any plant. There are many other examples, but our purpose is to chronicle past and current events in this recondite domain. Alchemy is a discipline that started way back in the annals of history, as best can be determined. Ancient Greek, Indians, Chinese, and Egyptians were practitioners of alchemy. However, we do not intend to go that far back. We will turn to the days of the 60s and 70s so that we may have some insight into Dr. Albert Riddell. Frater Albertus, as he preferred being called, supervised and operated what is called a mystery school in the Wasatch Mountain Range in Utah. Located in Salt Lake City area, this school taught a curriculum of very interesting subjects. These included Kabbalah, the ancient Hebrew technique of spiritual growth, which incorporates the tenet of magic, astrocyclical pulsations, astrology, and alchemy. The school was run in the matter of a Gurdjieff Fourth Way school. Dr. Israel Regardi, who was my friend and mentor, suggested this school to me. At the same time, the person who had taught me the rudiments of Kabbalah, Dan T., also referred to this school, indicating I would do well to look into it. Simultaneously, Mary F. invited me to her home to meet two people who had an unusual hobby, alchemy. These two people, Kurt and Helene von K., were destined to become good friends and teachers of mine. They talked about alchemy and how they cured their son of mental dysfunction through the use of alchemical preparations. They showed us a small vial of an oily substance and declared this was oil of iron. As a graduate civil engineer and an MBA, and 20 years in the hard and logical discipline of information systems, I could not readily accept what they told me. My engineering background always insisted that I should see, feel, taste, and touch things to verify their reality. I'd never heard of oil of iron, nor the oil of any other metals, so it could not possibly exist. That was my mindset at the time. Nevertheless, they managed to capture my interest. What got me excited was they had studied under one Frater Albertus at the very same school I had so recently heard so much about, the Paracelsus Research Society. They explained how to apply for the school and tantalized Mary and I with many stories of alchemy. It did not take long for me to get on the telephone with Doc and with Dan. They urged me to go. The clincher was Bill, an Episcopalian priest, committed to attend, and Mary decided to go as well. We applied, were accepted, and soon found ourselves in Salt Lake City at the PRS, awaiting the commencement of the Prima class. The night before, the meeting room was abuzz with the new students, 16 in all ready to start the first of 7 2-week courses at PRS to learn the rudiments of alchemy. Everyone was intensely interested in everyone else as to how they came here, what they were into, and so on. It turned out the students were into a variety of things. There was a couple from Canada who had studied alchemy, best said for many years under the guidance of God Mercury. There was an opera singer and her husband, who was a conductor of a symphony, as well as being a concert pianist. He had been a child prodigy and had studied under Koff Daly. There was a sweet old lady in her late 70s who was into crocheting, a computer programmer, a chiropractor, a chap who told us he was the master of the martial arts of sword and gave us some fascinating demonstrations of power, a higher energy PhD candidate from Norway studying at MIT, an industrial engineer, a surrealist artist, a chemist, who was to perform some incredible alchemical experiments later on, a medical doctor, a priest, a lady who had been the secretary to a state governor and civil engineer. A mixed crew indeed. Yet before long, sharing this special experience, we came to be good friends. Most of those friendships are as strong as ever today. Everyone buttonholed everyone else and got into serious discussions of all sorts. The martial arts expert, in answer to my question as to what this brought him, said, "I can tell past lifetimes from the aura." Well, I urged him to read my past lifetime. He squinted at me, sort of over and behind me, and I could scarce conceal a smirk. Boy, was he coming on. After a few minutes, he told me I had been a worker in the pyramids of Egypt, but was killed in an accident. I was stunned. This was the precise substance of a recurring dream I had had as a teen, that I was working as a stonemason in a pyramid when a block of stone struck me in the head and I died. This little incident was to be the first of many weird and often disquieting events during this class. The next morning we assembled in the meeting room. Per instructions from Soro Emmy, bright and early, we could hardly await the arrival of Frater Albertus. He arrived promptly and seated himself at the head of the table, saying, as he was to do for the beginning of every class I took, "Good morning, everyone," and then became silent and allowed his eyes to rest for a few minutes on each student. We all felt he could read our minds, and the class got a little restless. Then he closed his eyes and seemed to drift off or something. After what seemed an eternity, his voice, strong and clear, said, "God is good." Then lapsed into silence, and the class closed its respective eyes and waited. After a short time, he spoke, "God is good," putting inflection on the last word of the same sentence. Again, a silence, followed by his speaking, "God is good." We meditated on the import of this for several minutes, and then he opened his eyes, as did the class, looked around at everyone thoughtfully, and started to dilate on this sentence. Each morning of every class, we started with this morning meditation, as he called it. It was amazing that he never used notes. He always had his talk perfectly memorized, and he never gave the same one twice in the 7 years that I was to take these classes. It was observed that he always wore a cardigan sweater and that the sweater was the correct color for the day. That is, red on Tuesday, orange on Wednesday, black on Saturday, etc. These are the corresponding planetary colors. In many ways, he was truly astonishing. He had been born on May the 5th, 1911, at 1:40 a.m. in Dresden, Germany. His hands were very large, belying the fact that he was an artist with a delicate touch. He was very powerful, as I found out, yet very gentle and patient. Frater Albertus was to initiate me into alchemy, and to be my teacher for the next 10 years until his death. Each day followed the same format, a morning meditation, followed by a session on Kabbalah, where we studied the Tree of Life and other Kabbalistic philosophies. He also taught astrocyclical pulsations, showing how all of life follows seemingly predictable cycles, just as like a sine wave. And of course, the mainstay of the studies was alchemy. Always a session on theory, followed by practical lab work, where we could prove or disprove the theory given. We learned that all substances consist of three essentials, and they could be separated, purified, and put back together again into a higher state. He helped guide us through the morass of alchemical writings, so often written to obscure words and more obscure meanings. The theory he gave us helped us to understand these writings and reveal them as extremely valuable aids to the student. He himself exemplified his belief in creating written records. Each experiment was performed was carefully written up in notes. These notes were, of course, kept by the student, and one set was put in the file of the PRS records. The three basics, which Frater told us all things were made of, were called by the alchemists sulfur, salt, and mercury. These are analogues of soul, body, and spirit, or Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, or Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu, or solids, liquids, gases. In fact, a large set of triplicities fit these terms. He described and showed us the differences in these three as they varied in the different kingdoms of vegetables, minerals, and animals. He taught us how to extract these from plants, how to purify them, and how to conjoin them again. His purpose was to show us the parallels between the kingdoms and how, using the spagyric technique, one could make medicines, potent medicines, medicines that were in the main different from those prescribed by orthodox physicians, as medicines that had been known for millennia, preserved in old wives' tales, American Indian lore, and in other occult repositories. As we shall see, these medicines are being revived and are available to the public. It is my belief that it is from alchemical medicines pernicious diseases will at last be overcome. These medicines consist initially of herbs and plants. Then we progress to working with such metals as antimony and iron. In PRS, we used as a text Basil Valentine's incredible book, The Triumphant Chariot of Antimony. Herein lies explicit, clear instructions on how to transmute a rank, poisonous element into one that can be used medically. This was, to be sure, antimony. From this matter, all manner of marvellous medicines can be made. While Basil Valentine set down many recipes, there are a few blinds in his writings. To be absolutely sure in preparing such medicaments, one should seek a teacher to guide the student through the little traps set for the unwary. It is interesting to note that in March 1987 issue of Ambix magazine, Dr. Lawrence Princip, now at Johns Hopkins University, wrote an article which he received a government grant to replicate the work done by Valentine in Triumphant Chariot. His research proved to be invaluable as he showed a few traps in the work and developed techniques to obtain the tincture of antimony by making this healing substance from the glass of antimony. In a conversation with him, I indicated it was not so much a miracle that he was indeed able to replicate the experiments, but that he had got the government grant for it. Larry injects the scientific disciplines into an archaic subject. In a different operation, we separated the essence of common chicken eggs and from the sulphur thereof produced a medicine salutary in incidences of atherosclerosis. This substance, an oil, is also marvellous as a topical. Jody, my wife, will not be without it as a skincare product. The metals, having long absorbed planetary influences, are far more powerful than herbs in healing. Consider the energy in half a fingernail covered with uranium. It could blow away a city, such as Hiroshima. How wonderful it would be if this energy were harnessed for healing rather than destruction. Frater told us about the alchemist's mercury and the stone of the philosophers, legendary alchemical items. He did not show us directly how to create these things, but gave us hints, stories, analogies, and insights. His method was, true to the code of alchemy, not to give anything away on a platter, but to make you work for it, to sweat for it. So it was to be years later on, that marvelous day, that I succeeded in making some potent alchemical medical product, as well as the sought-for goal of alchemists, mercury. Oh, not quicksilver, but the philosopher's mercury, the universal dissolvent. When my friend and teacher, Dan T., helped me achieve this goal, I literally fell on my knees to thank the Father for his grace in discovering the secret to me. This is a product that thousands have strived for, and yet few have obtained. Through all of this, Freda was ever mindful of and conveyed to us the goodness of love of our common Father for all his children. Indeed, as indicated by Valentine and others, the revelation of preparing these alchemical gifts were a direct gift of God. I don't think anyone in this domain doubts that. To augment this spiritual aspect, Freda read to us from other canonical texts as the King James Bible. He opened us up to new ideas as to how Kabbalah and alchemy were quite prevalent in this holy book. In fact, we were all amazed as he offered proof after proof to substantiate his statements that the Bible is a manual for alchemy and contained many secrets of those who have eyes to see. In my classes and seminars, I cite examples from such canonical texts as the Bible to show how these texts are written in a code, a symbolic code that must be penetrated in order to glean the true and hidden meaning. As an example, there is a section in John that shows how to prepare the philosopher's mercury. Genesis is a treasure house of mysteries not discerned by the casual reader. As Paracelsus told us, the Kabbalah, a spiritual discipline that is part and parcel of alchemy, opens all sealed epistles. At the end of the 7-year cycle at Paris, I had absorbed a good deal of alchemical knowledge. In fact, I got hooked on it. As a former counselor in a drug program, this is the only addiction I can safely say is healthy. Perhaps equally important to the teachings were the many different groups of people I had met. Our bonding in PRS enabled us to remain in close touch, even to this day. Subsequent to the classes, I have met fellow alchemists from every part of the globe. We too maintain a network. Now, while we were still attending PRS classes, Freda founded Paralab, a company chartered to prepare alchemical or spagyrical, as they are more correctly called, preparations for public sale. These were both medicinal and cosmetic items. Unfortunately, Paralab proved to be before its time. He also wrote quite a few books. He taught the classes, mowed the lawns, and was a man of boundless energy. However, he once told us that all this would end, that alchemical mystery schools each operated in their own cycle, and PRS also had to end. But before this came about, he transmuted PRS into Paracelsus College. He dreamt and set the ideas down on paper of TriStar, a spectacular alchemical research and healing center, woven into the architecture were the symbols of alchemy, a sort of modern Gothic cathedral. Plans were drawn up, models made to scale, monies began to be appropriated, then he died. It was July 1984 when a dream and a reality left this plane. Since he, for some reason, did not groom anyone for his replacement, the light has gone out. The college sits idly and no classes are being taught. Books he had in manuscript form may never see the light of day. There is no one on the horizon to pick up the torch he lit, but he inculcated alchemy into many who will never forget him, and more, who will continue to carry out the alchemy. The people whose lives he touched may number into the thousands. Many are actively engaged in their practical alchemy or in allied research. Most of those are in communication with one another to share ideas and results. My personal activity in networking started with producing retyped and translated copies of old alchemical texts. This has caused many a student to knock at my door. It is a rare day when I don't write some fellow alchemists somewhere in the world. There are more alchemists than I dreamt of. Poland, Switzerland, France, Germany, Italy, New Zealand, Norway, India, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, Australia, and other countries. Before examining alchemy today, let us take a brief look at the principles behind the phenomena of alchemy. Firstly, as indicated, alchemists consider all things as composed of three essential, sulfur, salt, and mercury. These are actually consciousness, sulfur, and verifying life force, mercury, and a vehicle in which the latter two are housed, salt. They correspond to soul, body, and spirit in that order. This is the same spirit and soul as found in religion. However, in alchemy, we learn how to separate these three so that they can be seen and held. This is part of the vast field of alchemical theory, but a theory that allows direct proof to be made. You can see, weigh, and taste these three essentials from the various kingdoms. This enables you to know and experience their existence rather than having faith. Alchemy trades off knowledge for belief. In the Indian alchemy called Ayurveda, the same principles apply under the term gunas and include sattva, consciousness, rajas, spirit or energy, and tamas, body or mass. Techniques for separation of these principles are available, as well as teachings for the threefold process, separation, purification, and coabation. As an example, in the plant world, one can extract the alchemical sulfur, which is the essential oil. Then one can extract from the putrefied plant, the spirit. This exhibits itself as alcohol. Happily, store-bought ethanol alcohol will do nicely. Finally, the residual of the plant, the fecal matter, is burned or calcined to a white ash or salt. These are all purified and then brought back together, coabated, and through a certain process can be formed into a stone-like matter, a plant stone. So we have killed the plant to enable it to give up its soul and spirit. Then we have reunited them and thus resurrected them in a new and glorified body. This product is the highest form of the plant attainable, philosophically speaking. Note that the plant could not do it for itself. It needed a higher power, in this case man, to accomplish this highest transmutation. The plant stone can not only perform interesting physical phenomena, but it is an extremely powerful medicine. That it may cure depends on what plants or herbs it was made from. The laws of astrology apply here. The plant stone is also a teaching device, as its confection is an exact analogy of how to make a stone in the other kingdoms. The curative powers of the plant stone are the focused and the concentrated healing powers of the original herb. If the herb has been rosemary, the part of the body it would heal would be the heart, as rosemary is the sun plant and the sun governs the heart. Further, the sage plant, governed by Venus, would also govern the kidneys, would be useful in kidney problems. Mercury governs valerian and the thyroid, so a goiter condition might be eased with a tincture from the valerian plant, or more likely cured with the valerian plant stone. While the sulfur is the major healing agent, utilizing spagyrically all the parts of the plant, a more efficacious medicine will obtain. Going a step further, we know that planets also have rulership over metals, as well as plants and specific parts of the body. The sun, for example, rules gold, and Venus rules copper. The sun also rules sunflowers, frankincense, and rue, as well as the heart. It should be clear, then, that the medicine can be made for specific parts of the body from metals, and that since metals have been around longer, absorbing beneficial rays, they will be more potent. Recall the analogue of uranium. How do you make a tincture from a metal? Why, just one does with the plant. As above, so below. I can personally attest to the efficacy of aurium potable, or tincture of gold. The process is one of extracting the sulphur of gold, purifying it, and using this product as a medicine. As mentioned, if one could combine the other two essentials, the effect would be absolutely astonishing. However, getting the other two essentials in the mineral kingdom is not so easily done. Returning to the present, what is happening now? Sources tell me that more alchemical information is being made available than ever before. Anyone walking in this field can tell you that. Alchemy is said to have Sufi roots. Frater Albertus, in his book The Alchemist of the Rocky Mountains, refers to this. He went so far as to say that the Hindu Kush Mountains, in a little town called Nuristan, alchemists were busy converting base metals into gold. The purpose was to prepare for the financing of the coming avatar. An atlas shows this town to be in Afghanistan. Did you ever wonder why the Soviets were so bent on getting into Afghanistan? There weren't all that many natural resources available. In fact, it is only a very hardy person that can eke a living from the difficult and hostile country. So what did they want? Could it be that they heard that someone was producing gold there? Maybe even mass-producing it. Who can say with certainty? The same resources mentioned said that the adepts who were there moved to France well in advance of the Russians. Again, anyone in this field will tell you that, yes indeed, France is a hotbed of alchemical activity. More groups being formed, more books being written, etc. Let's consider some specifics in various countries, including France. Australia is very hot when it comes to alchemy. As an example, Dr. Manfred Genius has formed Austral Herbola to formulate various spagyric products. He combines the essences of herbs, all three essentials, with honey and other natural substances. These products will nourish the body like no other substance can. His herbal wines are the spirit of plants extracted, purified, and combined with other essences to create an invigorating and stimulating beverage. These qualities are imbibed with the herbs used. Would you believe a healthy wine? These products are now being distributed in the United States. Dr. Genius, a friend, has written excellent books on alchemy, gives concerts playing the sitar, and he also teaches alchemy and otherwise shares that which he has been given through lectures and seminars. Dr. Genius will be in Dallas the last week of July 1990 to teach a one-week course in alchemy. George and Clean, together with his wife Ulrich, have formed Julique Ageless Skincare Products. He was a student of Rudolf Steiner and taught at the Waldorf School. Dr. Steiner was a brilliant man, and his pioneering work with herbs and plants are carried on today by the Waleda Company, who offer various health and cosmetic preparations. Dr. Conway in New Zealand, who was a student of Frater Albertus, as was Dr. Genius, founded a firm to compound creams and emollients with natural ingredients using spagyric techniques, that is, alchemical processes. On Connaught Circus in New Delhi, we find the Ayurvedic Pharmacy, where alchemical products are sold over the counter and are compounded to prescription. Out in front of the pharmacy, we find workers with huge iron mortars and pistols. With it, they grind metals laboriously by hand for months. Day after day, they grind a particular metal or gem into a powder so fine it is almost a liquid. These are then treated and mixed with other ingredients to make medicines. Diamond powder will yield a medicine for the brain, and gold bhasma oxide is salutary for the heart. And many Indian preparations contain shilajit, which is obtained from a certain type of rock from the Himalayas. This rock, under the influence of moonlight, oozes out a tar-like substance. It is this tar-like material that is used to provide medicinal effects. Alchemy is especially flourishing today in France. Jean Dubois leads a group called Les Philosophes de la Nature. The organization boasts a membership of over 1,500 people, all practicing alchemy. I mentioned this organization to friends in Colorado, and it was decided to organize American branch. The lessons from France are translated into English and offered to English-speaking alchemical students as a correspondence course. The lessons span a number of years and include Kabbalah as well as spiritual and practical alchemy. These lessons are being offered today, and Karen Kabbalah in Casper, Georgia, offers a very complete set of lessons dealing with the Kabbalah. In the fall of 1986, I spent a week with an alchemical society called Filiation Solar Zarif. They held a pilgrimage in the woods of southern France. They proved alchemy can be done in the wild without the trappings of modern equipment and store-bought chemicals. Solar Zarif is a powerful and charismatic man who is well-versed in alchemy. He and his followers consider themselves to be the guardians of alchemy, and in particular in the service of La Dame, the Virgin. In Germany, Barbara Thies formulates herbal medicines and markets them. And in Germany, long a bastion of alchemy, numerous hermetic groups flourish. In Belgium, Dr. I. Beck spearheads alchemical studies. In Antwerp and in Brussels, Marcel Jurusek is researching the properties of magnesium as a cure for AIDS. In Switzerland, a group that studied under Augusto Pancaldi are busy translating his writings from Italian to German, while my group, RAMS, is busy translating German into English. Augusto was a gentle and knowledgeable alchemist. It was he who arranged for Frater Albertus and Eugene Cancellite, the latter served under the master Fulcanelli, who legend reputes to be hundreds of years old, to meet and exchange views. It is regrettable that all three of these giants of alchemy have passed through transition. However, Urs G. and Alois W. keep the work of Pancaldi ongoing. Siegfried H. in Canada reports that there is a Swiss PRS group that follows the precepts laid down by Frater Albertus, even to the extent that they make spagyric preparations. Also in Canada, Ralph F. has started an alchemical study group. In Spain, Julian P. and Portuguese José A. typify alchemists who, with members of their group, search the writings of the ancient alchemists to extract clues to be more successful in their alchemical endeavors. Germany, Switzerland, and England have organizations publishing alchemical journals. Arthur Ferez in Australia relates he is working on a new technique to obtain oil of iron. He teaches alchemy in 2-week seminars. It is recalled that oil of iron is helpful in problems concerning the head. It has proved most effective in severe headaches and might prove effective in amnesia and other such head-related problems. Better than anything else you can get in a drugstore, we might add. Paul Baines in England is making spagyric extracts of the herb Fo Ti Tien. The Chinese refer to this herb as one containing the elixir of life and use it to promote longevity. Finally, my friend Pierre Manure has developed a method to solidify quicksilver, and he shapes it into religious and magical shapes. He learned his alchemy from teachers in India. He also makes and sells purified oils of metals. In America, alchemy is also alive and well. Will S.W. is following the general lines of study as Paul Baines, but compounds his products from cactus, aloe vera, and creosote. He is quite involved in bio-agro products. Perhaps not so alchemical, but a great importance to preserve this planet nonetheless. Robbie Ewer and Art F. have combined talents to produce a remarkable salve, combining aloe vera and gold. This salve I have used and helped distribute is amazing in the relief of pain from a variety of causes. Betty McKay in San Diego discovered that by heating ethyl alcohol in a small flask, the alcohol will gradually turn color and finally congeal and become a dark brown mass, just like chocolate syrup. However, in time the mass will start to pulse or beat like a heart. If I had not seen this phenomenon myself, I would not have believed it. What it is, we do not yet know. All we know is that the combined action of a sand bath, morning light from an eastern window, and a green light shining on it makes it behave in a particular fashion. Greg Collins relates that due to the history of family chronic cancer, he had a checkup. In his great dismay, polyps were discovered in his colon by his physician. He decided to try some alchemical preparations and took a colloidal extract combining gold, silver, and copper. In addition, he took 3 drops of gold tincture once a week. 5 weeks later, his physician, after exploratory examination, announced the polyps went away. A checkup in May this year reconfirmed the efficacy of the gold tincture. Mary Lynn of Iowa read a passage in biblical Exodus that gave her a clue to making perfumes. It gave her insight on how to extract from a handful of dried flower petals copious quantities of essential oil. From this oil, she made delicate and exquisite perfumes. Her pupil, Peter B., still produces perfumes from the generated oils. George F. is overseeing the printing of a book by Mary Lynn describing her techniques. George, a beautiful man and friend, conducts private research into alchemy and has been a 50-year member of the Esoteric RC Order, AMORC. Dan T. used his knowledge of alchemy to make herbal flavorings. These are used to create delicious beverages often found for sale in health food stores. Dr. Jack Hines and his son Shane have an organization, Apotheca Natural, that produces a variety of spagyric tinctures. Dr. Dan Clark of Melbourne, Florida, has formed Bioactive Nutrients and offers spagyric and homeopathic tinctures and remedies. Howard Wilson has developed an incredible biodegradable solvent that will radically dissolve gold. The marvel of this invention is that it contains no corrosives, no toxins, and one of the main constituents is water. This could be a great boon for anyone in gold mining business. Ore containing a variety of elements are introduced into this fluid and it radically dissolves only the gold. A second fluid precipitates the gold back out and recovers it at the 99.6% level. Bill Van D. has developed nutrients that will feed gold and make it multiply. Peter M. grows gold crystals. Other people are engaging in making exotic palliatives and cures, doing private research, and so on. Surely this business with gold sounds, well, far-fetched. But that is probably due to a lack of exposure and to awareness of these recondite disciplines. Yet we read that Dr. Paul Cottle of the University of Florida, utilizing a linear accelerator, hurls lithium ions at gold and converts it to lead. Shades of wrong way, Corrigan. Dr. Cotty, of course, was trying to prove something about the functioning of atomic nuclei. He also gave weight to the idea that transmutation is entirely possible. But Bainbridge, Scher, and Starr proved that in the 1940s, as have recent experiments in Australia, alchemists, who have transmuted quicksilver into silver and have created artificial gems indistinguishable from the real thing. And as exemplified by Larry Prinsel's research, the governments of various countries have shown to be quite interested in alchemy. A paper studying the possibilities of producing work from the heat given off by transmutations concedes that the work of Cauchy, Couvreur, and others are correct, that is, transmutations do take place. This paper was written by the US Army. Beyond this, there is actually a tremendous amount of alchemical activity taking place. As previously indicated, hundreds of researchers are in the laboratories trying to wrestle the secrets of healing and of life itself from nature. Many closely follow the teachings of the ancient alchemists, reading texts written long ago. They try to decipher the archaic and code-like words often written in foreign languages. To aid them, my group, RAMS, is involved in translating old alchemical texts and transmuting these ancient manuscripts from dusty items taking up space into a form readable and thus usable. It is hoped that some researchers will discover a new approach or even a key to unlock secrets heretofore hidden away. To some extent, this has already been the case. These are usually not large organized groups, but clusters of individuals now turned on to the possibilities promised by alchemy. And to some extent, folk concerned about the environment and pollution seeking better ways. Russell Schilling in Atlanta, Ron DeSalvo in Marina Del Rey, Dana M. in Marietta, Robert M. in Marshfield, Anthony House and Laura J., both in Seattle, Mac Rose in Australia, and a veritable legion of individuals attuned into the same philosophy and trying to use alchemy to help their brothers and sisters. We would be remiss not to mention other literary efforts in the Hermetic field. These include publications such as the Hermetic Journal, published in England by the tireless Adam McLean, the eclectic magazine Gnosis, Dr. Hoffman's Four Worlds Journal, the French journals Template Comique and La Tablette Emeraude, a newsletter emanating from Israel Kabbalah, the Swiss alchemical German language journal Essentia, the venerable Ambics from England. From the US, we find Clauda Pravo and Hermetica, both published in academic environments, and of course, the venerable Fate. Mr. Rittman, in Amsterdam, has opened to the public an incredible library of alchemical documents. This is the Bibliotheca Philosophica Hermetica. Tom Brown's Borderland Sciences group often have articles on Hermetic subjects. The American branch of the Les Philosophes de la Nature will soon produce a newsletter to add to a growing number of alchemical journals. They are based in Boulder, Colorado. We can see then that there is quite a bit on, with or without our knowledge. There are many, many groups and individuals then imagined working quietly, even secretly, doing research, conducting experiments, testing, and finally, it is hoped, coming up with those products that are more potent in healing. Perhaps some of these researchers will be instrumental in bridging the wide gap between the alchemist and the scientist. It might be asked, and who are these people? Since I travel all over the US and beyond, giving lectures, classes, and seminars, I can answer that question with accuracy. The answer is the neighbor down the street, your Sunday school teacher, the milkman, and a host of others that one would not suspect as being involved in arcane studies. They are without doubt out there, and they aren't mysterious or sinister folk either. They are sincere, probably very spiritual people dedicated to a common good. One day, like Sir Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton, they will come out of the closet. Hopefully, at that time, the fruits of their discoveries in alchemy, like Boyle and Newton, will be recognized and utilized to heal mankind of all his illnesses, both spiritual and physical, as the good Lord told us in Genesis. All these things, plants, herbs, minerals, etc., are here for our use and benefit, to nourish and sustain and heal us. Thus it was he that instituted this holy art and science. He left us the challenge and joy of discovering the deepest secrets of matter. Truly, as Frater Albertus was wont to say, God is good.
This article was written by Hans Nitzel and read by Andrew Kittel. To support this podcast, visit www.ramsdigital.com.